Welcome to The Daisy Project, a podcast where we have meaningful conversations with entrepreneurs, leaders, and change makers on what it means to live a meaningful life and also on how they got to where they are now. Cool. So today's guest is a social entrepreneur, disability rights advocate, and culture change agent. She's passionate about representation and equality. She's been featured on BBC, Sky News, Huffington Post, and Financial Times. She's a founder of the Diversibility Card and Asian Woman Festival in the United Kingdom. I'm excited to introduce you to Shani Dunder.
Hi.
It's so good to have you on the podcast. We've just been chatting beforehand, which has been fantastic. So I feel like I've really got to know you. Thanks so much for making time.
No, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. It's lovely to meet you.
I'm really excited to dive into this conversation because I already feel like I've heard so much about your story. But I really want to start with where did you find the courage and what was the impetus to start the Asian Women Festival?
Sure. So the Asian Woman Festival is the UK's first of its kind event, and here in the UK we have a huge South Asian population, and I myself, as an Asian woman, was looking for an event to go to where I could meet like-minded Asian women, talk about things that were important to me, you know, talk about how we learn from each other, how we can empower and inspire each other, but it just didn't exist. I looked high and low, and I found some events that were in London, but it wasn't really anything that I thought, well, how is it different? And I just couldn't find anything. So my background is in event management. I've done that now for over 10 years, and I thought, okay, well, if anyone's going to do it, I've got the skill set, the knowledge, the contacts, why don't I start it? And when I was looking for events, the only kind of events I could find were like if you wanted to book a wedding or buy a new lehenga, and I don't want to do either of those things.
I love that.
So, and you know, when I often say that when I'm asked about, you know, why do I start the festival, everybody always laughs at that, but they laugh in agreement with me because those are the only events that exist. And that just goes to show that as a society, that's if that's the only thing on offer to Asian women, mm-hmm. what kind of message are we sending there, that yeah. you're only good if you get married, or do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
We need to change that. So off I went. I floated the idea around to a few of my contacts. I said, how does this sound? Everyone was super supportive. But it was really difficult to get it off the ground. It was a new concept. It was a new brand. And I really wanted the event to have a festival feel. I didn't just want to brand it as a festival and then we just sat and talked all day. But the event was a whole day of panel talks. There were interactive workshops. We had a festival bazaar. So we had over 50 independent retailers. There might have been artists. They could have been selling anything from jewelry to candles to their services, for example. We had street food, we had performances, music, and we even curated our very own exhibition with over 30 artists.
Wow, that's phenomenal. Yeah. So, and you're saying when you launched it, you were expecting how many people to show up and how many showed up?
Yeah, so, you know, with it being so new, I wasn't really expecting that many people. I thought maybe at the most, 200, but we actually had over 1,000 people there on the day. And it was a ticketed event, and prior to the event, we were just, shy of selling around 800 tickets. So on the day, to have got over 1,000, it was just incredible. And, you know, I often say, I think I cried about 10 times because when you're the event manager, you're just focused on getting through the event, managing the event, managing everybody's expectations. And I was sat there, I was in the audience, and suddenly I was like, this is it. It's here. It's happening right now. I just got really overwhelmed. Mm.
And I think it's such a generous act. I've been in sort of organizing different events as well. And I think it's such a generous act to create a space for others to shine. And that's what I think the Asian Women Festival is doing in terms of giving a stage to people and voices to those who don't normally get into mainstream media, right?
Absolutely. And for me, it was really important that we created a safe space for women to talk about things that they may not be able to, either, you know, with their family or with their friends. So some of the talks that we had were about sexuality and relationships, disability, anti-blackness in our community, because that's something that's still very prevalent. You know, our headline panel talk was, what does it even mean to be an Asian woman in today's society? You know, we've got all of this history, we've got culture, but actually, if you're British or if you're here in the UK and you're English, how do you navigate that? And as it would be in any other society, whether, you know, it's America, Australia, Canada, you know.
That's very interesting. I'm actually very curious. I mean, touching on that, for you, your experience growing up, tell me a little bit about your family, your background, and how, I guess, your background has played a role in your identity.
Sure. So my background is that a Punjabi Sikh family. My dad was born in India but came to the UK himself as a young child. My mum and all her siblings were born here. It was my grandparents that first came to the UK. So I'm from Birmingham and I'm a very proud Brummie. That's what we call people from Birmingham. but I now live in London for work. And I was brought up in quite a tight-knit Asian community. I think we're very lucky here in the UK that we have big pockets of Asians and big communities. And, you know, my family are quite prevalent in the Sikh community. Quite prevalent in the Sikh community as well. So I always say that my house was like King's Cross Station, which is like one of the busiest stations in the UK. People always coming in and out. And I loved it as a child. But I think my experiences are probably a bit different from my siblings because I was born with a rare genetic condition. So even though it's genetic, it doesn't run in my family. I'm what they call a spontaneous mutation, which is fun to be.
Spontaneous mutation.
But it meant that I was born with a condition where my bones used to break without any trauma. Wow. And due to the condition, I have a short stature of 3'10". So by the age of 14, I had broken my legs 6 times.
Wow.
And that might sound like a lot, but I'm actually very lucky because other people with my condition, they break up to 300 to 400 times in their lifetime. So 6 breaks is absolutely nothing. And they were all whilst I was a child. So I'm very, very grateful that, you know, in my adulthood, I haven't broken. So growing up, it was an interesting time because I think people constantly had low expectations because I had a very visible condition. And unfortunately, disability, or, you know, when you live with a condition or an impairment, it just has a much more negative sense of stigma in the South Asian community. And what's really sad is that, you know, I'm 32 years old and I really haven't seen anything change. But that has inspired me to do a lot of disability rights advocacy. I set something up called the Asian Disability Network, which is an online platform, because growing up, you know, I never saw myself represented, you know, as an Asian woman or with someone who had a condition. And I'm a huge believer in you can't be what you can't see. And I think for me, I want to help inspire the next generation. I don't want them to have the same negative experiences that I did, you know. And it's just little things, like I often get called an inspiration, but getting up and brushing my teeth in the morning, that's not inspiring. Like maybe some of the other things I've done, like Asian Woman Festival, that's fine. Yeah. Call me an inspiration for that. But I think, I don't know, people often focus on what people can't do instead of what they can do.
Yeah, focusing on who you are at the moment rather than what you're doing, which I think some of the stuff's phenomenal around the Asian Woman Festival. Yeah. Rather than just focusing on identity as well, I think
for me, like, I'm definitely very passionate about representation because I know how powerful it is and what the consequences are when we lack representation.
All right, continue.
So yeah, I'm really passionate about representation because it's such a powerful thing, you know. How do you know what you can be in society if you're not seeing it? And we both know, and many of your listeners will know, that there are South Asian women out there that are doing incredible things, but in comparison to their peers, they're just not getting that same level of recognition or platforms. So
yeah, and often they need to work sort of three times as hard to get any recognition.
Yeah, and you know, as a woman, especially, you know, speaking in my own experience, it's layer upon layer. So, you know, if I talk about employment, as a woman who has a condition, I'm twice as likely to be unemployed. As someone who is from a BAME background, I'm three times as likely to be unemployed. And then if I ever get there, as a woman, I'm highly likely to be paid less than my male counterparts. Yeah. So it's like, how many layers and glass ceilings does someone have to actually go through just to get to a level playing field?
Yeah. I want to touch on what I've noticed about you is your sense of ambition and also your sense of culture. So I want to know, how have you sort of reconciled these two, your sense of ambition with your cultural expectations from maybe family and community and maybe of yourself?
Sure. So I think that's a great question. So I think in terms of like ambition and expectation, so I've always had certain expectations for myself, and I knew what kind of lifestyle that I wanted to live. So, you know, my background is that I was actually sent to a special needs primary school because of my condition, because that was the best place for my physical needs. But inclusion is very different now to what it was 30 years ago. Mm. But that wasn't the best place for me for my learning. And I think that didn't help then with the wider community's perception of me and my ability, because I was sent to a special needs school. And, you know, I then went to a secondary mainstream school, but I struggled a lot because I just missed loads of school because I was in hospital a lot. Two, because I was at a special needs school, but I loved it. I didn't know any different, and I played all day. And as a kid, like, what kid doesn't want to play all day? But I remember coming home and saying, "Mom, I need a tutor." Tell me what kid asks for a tutor? But, you know, it was a really hard time as a kid. I just thought, oh my God, how am I ever going to get a job? I can't even keep up in class. So I feel like I've always had to work a lot harder to get where I am. But I've always had a sense of ambition that I want to be independent. I don't want to rely on anybody for anything. And I remember, like, when I got my first job, people were saying to me, "Why are you working? You're entitled to benefits. You can just sit at home and you don't have to do anything." And, like, I've never had that mentality. I've always had so much to give, and I've always wanted to be a contribution to society. And, you know, admittedly, as a young woman, I never thought I'd be out here doing so much advocacy around disability, because for me, as an identity, as maybe a young 20-year-old, it was something I shied away from. Mm-hmm. I would never want to associate myself and say I was disabled. And it's not that, oh, I've turned 30 and all of a sudden I do. It's that actually I'm more at peace with it. I understand the difference of experiencing disability and how you experience it through barriers or bias. But the way I experience it is that I'm born with a condition, and I only experience disability when I'm faced with certain limitations. So it's not the condition that I was born with that disables me.
No, it's this external environment.
Yeah. So that's what we call the social model of disability. But I feel that in South Asian communities, it's still very medicalized.
It's more put into the person that you're disabled, you're unable to do things, as opposed to the environment around you isn't designed around your needs. Absolutely. Right. I did a workshop on disability actually when I was living in Thailand. So I remember they showed a very powerful image of this, of, I think it was someone on a wheelchair, and they showed a staircase, and then they showed the person at the bottom of the staircase in the wheelchair, and they said, What in this image is not functional? Like, what's not working here? And everyone's like, well, the staircase is not really working for him. Yeah. It's not him. He's fine. And so it's just a very powerful image that always got me thinking about how we view people as the word disability, that you're disabled, right? But it's not so much, well, your environment is making you disabled, not so much you, and that provides a different perspective.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, I always say that I'm 3'10". I have to think outside of the box every single day. Even, I have to plan the way that I travel. Here in London, I rent, so it's not like everything's custom built to my height. You know, I have to think about things that probably people would never even have to think about. But that makes me a really good event manager because I
have to plan ahead, right?
I'm so good at, you know, thinking outside of the box and in a way that people don't have to think. And I didn't go into event management knowing that or thinking that way. And it was maybe like midway through my career and people, you know, when people used to say things to me, they were like, how did you think of that? Like, that's such a good idea. What gave you that inspiration? And it is, you know, that's the beauty of diversity, isn't it? That you get different people from different backgrounds, different ways of thinking. And for me, so what people think is my disability is actually my ability. And I've carved that into a career and everything. And quite often, you know, we always focus on what people can't do instead of what they can do. And I think that's something I really want to help people think differently about.
I think that's definitely so powerful. I want to move to the topic of, I guess, about leadership and being bold. What does it mean to you to be bold? I'm curious.
I think to me, at different stages of my life, it's meant different things. So I think it's about having the courage to say what you really feel. I think being bold means going into something and just really taking it and running with it, knowing it might fail, but having the courage to think, you know what, I'm going to give this a go. Let's see how it works out. I'm going to give it my all. But actually, I think being brave, that's what bold means to me, and being a disruptor as well.
And where does that come from for you, that sense of I need to do something? Like, oh, because a lot of people will look at all the problems in the world and say, well, that's not working. But they might not get up and find the courage to propose a solution and then to own that solution themselves. You've definitely done that. I've looked at, I guess, even beyond what you're doing now, previously you've done a lot of different initiatives. I've noticed you seem to get involved with these things and to lead it or to be involved significantly in the solution. Where has that come from you?
I think for me, a lot of it has got to do with my upbringing. You know, we as a family, especially my dad, advocates for other people, other Sikhs around the world, especially in India as well, where, you know, Sikhs are a minority and are often treated quite differently, you know, sometimes not very favorably. So that was what I was surrounded with as a child. And it was like, if you're in a position where you can make a change, you have a voice and it's your responsibility to use it. And I think also I've had to advocate for myself so much, not only in my own circle, in my own family and friend circle, you know, I've had to be the educator in a lot of situations. But I felt that in society, when we talk about disability, the mainstream conversation was always had by people who were white and British and nobody of colour or ethnic minority. And if those people aren't around that table, that means there are stories that are missing, and you're missing out on all of the cultural aspects of that person's life. So I know I will experience things in a different way to someone that has got my condition who isn't from an Asian community because of different cultures, you know, what my religion says about disability and things like that, so on and so forth. So I think it's been a whole host of things, but I guess I've just been brought up doing it, maybe unknowingly.
And that it sounds like your father's definitely had a prominent role in terms of being the advocate, so someone that's been a role model for you.
Yeah.
What other role models have you had in your life that really inspire you?
Yeah, I think this is so cliche, but my mom. My mom, I've got so much to thank her for, but growing up, you know, it was easy for her to treat me differently, but she never did. Ever, you know, so I'd have long time spells when my legs would be in plaster, so I was heavily reliant on them, even to like go to the toilet, go to bed, have a bath, you know. But my mum would give me a pile of laundry to fold. She's like, don't think that just because you're in plaster, you're getting away with doing the chores. Like, that's so cool. I think the one thing that she taught me is that life is hard, and especially when you've got maybe different needs, additional needs, whatever you want to call it. You know, when you live in a world that isn't designed for you, life's not going to really be easy and people aren't going to give you special treatment, so you're not going to get it at home. And that, like, that lesson in itself has made me, I guess, has shaped who I am. But so has also, you know, my religion. So being a Sikh, doing selfless service, seva, the three pillars of Sikhism, like giving back, helping others.
What does seva mean to you?
Seva means to me just selfless service, helping others without actually wanting anything in return.
Wow.
And to me, like, I feel so fortunate that I live here in the UK. We've got access to so many resources, facilities. I live in a great country where you're supported, you know, by welfare if you need to be. Whereas, you know, I've got family in India and they're not. And there's so many other people out there that would benefit so much from this support. Not only do I have that and that support network, I've got my family, I've got my friends. I'm so rich with all of these things. Like, I'm not motivated by money whatsoever, but that makes me feel that I'm in a position where I can give back and I want to give back and I want to create change in society.
Wow, that's so inspiring. I'm curious, what are the things that, like, the stumbling blocks that have come, I guess, in your way in organising the first Asian Women Festival? Because I know events are never smooth sailing. I've organised several when before, especially an event of a scale with 1,000 people in attendance and the first of its kind. I'm curious, what were some of the stumbling blocks? What were the issues or challenges you faced that you weren't really expecting? You're like, because you've got a, you know, you've had a career in events. Were there things or was there nothing?
There were. And one thing that really surprised me is that I found it quite difficult to get high profile Asian women.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it was because we didn't have big budget or whether it was because it was the first event and people kind of wanted to see how the first one went. But I definitely feel that now we're planning our second event, the vibe out there is very different now we've done our first event. I guess people, you know, might be a bit sceptical. It's a new brand. It's a new concept. I guess people want to ensure that in exchange, you know, for their money and their time, something good, they're going to be attending something really good and worthwhile. I think we've absolutely demonstrated that now from the first event. So I think that was the first thing that I was surprised about and was a stumbling block.
And you mentioned the first event was entirely self-funded as well to get it off the ground, right?
Yeah, so from a monetary perspective, I poured my heart, soul and whole finances into it as well, because again, when we tried to get sponsorship, people just weren't as forthcoming. They were like, oh, you know, we're not quite sure. Do your first event and come back.
Yeah. And now you've done it though, right? Now you've gone back and you have got funding for the second event, right?
But it just makes me think, like, how many other people are out there that have got ideas and that maybe don't have so much money to put into it, you know, and that don't get the opportunity to get funding. Like, what are we missing out on? Like, I'm not rich, but I put a considerable amount of money into it. Luckily, you know, I broke even. I wasn't even expecting to, but this is something I felt so passionate about. I was willing to do that, but I understand that not everybody can. I think that is a major stumbling block, but not only for me, probably for many others as well.
I think I have so much respect for people who, like you're saying, it was hard to get high profile speakers, but I have so much respect for those who do give a chance to new things, because I think often I've had that experience too, where it's difficult to lock in certain people because you're starting out, right? Yeah. But helping people who start out compared to helping established brands are two different things. And I think that is a form of giving back.
Absolutely. And I think if there is anybody listening to this, helping people that are starting out is the most crucial, because once you're on your way, you know, that path's created then, but at first you're digging that path on you. So
what are different ways you think, for some of the people listening, that they might be able to support or back early starters? Because it's not always the most obvious.
Yeah. Do you know what?
Where do you find them? How do you support them?
Sure. I think for me, even something as easy as sharing a post, sharing content, I had a lot of people say, oh, my friend told me about this. Like, that in itself is huge. And, you know, some of the people that we've got on our team, which is all South Asian, some hadn't heard of Asian Woman Festival. And it was actually someone in a different country that told them, oh, you're in the UK, this is going on, why don't you go to it?
Wow. Like,
that is incredible to me. It's you know, it's a huge world, but then also it's such a small world as well when you're connected. Mm-hmm. So, you know, support doesn't always have to be money or turning up. It can be those other things like supporting from a distance, sharing something, championing something.
Yeah. No, I love that because I think what happens in Australia, I don't know if you have something here called, have you heard of the tall poppy syndrome?
No.
Okay, so that must be an Australian thing. So the tall poppy syndrome is this idea, it's very prevalent in Australian culture, is that anyone who sticks out, like you don't, it's not seen upon favorably.
Yeah.
So in Australia, people want you to do well, generally speaking, it's generalization. Yeah. It's not, you know, it doesn't always hold true, but generally speaking, they want you to do well, but they don't want you to do so well that you're doing better than them.
Yeah.
But then when you are, like when you're famous or you've really made it, then everyone's behind
you. Yeah, yeah.
And so it's really interesting. I try my best, and I love that I see you do this too, is to sort of encourage people who are getting started, right? Mm-hmm. And because that's the time when there isn't that support,
yeah.
right? And that's a time when, like, so an example I like to use is, like, I think the first time I posted it online on Facebook, I'm going to start a startup or something. I think there's like 5 likes and lots of concerned messages saying, why are you doing that? Are you still studying your law degree?
Aww.
And then my parents were like, what is this startup business? Like, what are you talking about? Do your law degree, get a job, get married, and then you can do what you want.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? but then, you know, posting a photo of me graduating, which is a great accomplishment. But my eyes, I mean, I work for a university here, so, but graduating versus starting a startup, like, I think both are very equally, like, not equally, but both are very difficult. But starting a startup is hard work.
Absolutely.
And getting it to work is very hard.
Yeah.
You know, there's no instructions given to you. Like, here's an assignment to you by this day. The deadlines aren't imposed on you. Yeah. You impose them on yourself.
And that's so much harder because, you know, but both of us, we have full-time jobs, and then we have so many, you know, other projects that we're involved in, and that's hard. It's hard to manage. It's hard to carve out a social life. It's hard to actually give the time that each project deserves as well. But I think for me, what I really love about Asian Women Festival is that we are able to give so many people different opportunities. So something that I didn't even think about would happen, but the artists, they sold so much work.
Wow.
Not only at the festival, but so many months after. And, you know, we're expanding that out this year. We're calling it the British Asian Art Festival. So that's something new because, again, South Asian artists, especially women, they're just not getting that same recognition. So we really want to champion that and give people the space. But also, you know, we gave people the space to promote their business there, to speak. We always share new initiatives on socials as well. So what I really love seeing after the festival is different things popping up. So, you know, people that attended, we inspired them to go off and do their own things in their own community.
You really created that space for them to gain that inspiration. And I think that's something that so many people can do and step up to create that space. So even if you're like listening and you're at like university and you launch a club or you just organize an event where you organize some speakers, it really takes nothing but some effort, right? I don't think that's something that takes like exorbitant planning, but I've always believed from my early days in unis, I've always created events and spaces where others come and it gives you experience to be an MC or to moderate a panel or something. But I think those are actually excellent ways to learn certain skills.
Yeah.
I did that throughout university. And I think it's one of the easiest things that people often miss, especially like, say, if you're studying an event management degree, it's like, okay, like I love what you do with Asian Women Festival. You're like, oh, I could do this. There's no conference or event that's a summit or, you know, a festival that appeals to me in the way I want. Wait, hang on. I've got an event management degree. And why don't I do it?
Yeah.
So to take that ownership is phenomenal. I want to touch on something you said just prior to when we were having a conversation. You recently took a sabbatical.
Yes.
Tell me a little about what happened there.
Sure. So it was in the last two years, I think. I can't remember. I took 3 months off work. So I've got a fair bit of family in India, and I'd only ever always gone to Punjab, obviously, because some people think that's all the India you need to see.
Well, especially Punjabis. It's like Punjab is the center of the universe
and it's
for them.
It's a bit of a shame because then that's what they view. Their view on India, you know, is just is just Punjab, and it's really not.
So I know, so much more to it.
Yeah. Right? So I was just sitting there thinking, actually, I've got friends that aren't even Indian that have seen more of India than me. I was like, this is my history, my heritage. So I thought, right, I'm going to take a sabbatical and travel around India. It was a massive decision to make. I kind of had to convince my parents that, you know, I would come back alive. But I decided to go alone. And I went for 3 months.
Yeah. And originally you're saying your mother wanted to come with you for the whole 3 months,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, my mom was like, oh, I want to come with you. I was like, no, mom. Whilst I would love that, I was like, this is my solo trip. I want it to be, you know, mine. You know, so many people came out to see me, which was really lovely. My mom came out for 2 weeks, but I spent 3 months going around 11 different states. And you know what? I even did go home and I spent half a day with my family. They're still angry with me that I was only there for half a day. But I was like, look, the last
as
10
in the
times,
family you had in India.
Yeah, the family I had in India. But I was like, look, the last 10 times I've been here, I was purely spent my time with you. So yeah, it was nice to see and do everything, but it was an incredible experience. I would say life-changing.
In what way? I'm curious.
It was, so every different state in India is like a different country. You know, you often think that if you can speak or understand Punjabi, you'll get by anywhere in India, and that's not the case at all. You know, pizza, I was in Goa and my taxi driver hadn't even heard of a Punjab. I was like, what? You don't know? I was like, what? I couldn't fathom that he didn't know.
I love that you couldn't fathom.
I was like, how can you have heard of Punjab? So yeah,
it you're just probably like, I haven't heard of Goa until I got here.
I think it reminds you of how insignificant you are. And I love that about travel. Like, I'm an avid traveler, so I think I've been to 32 countries now. I really love travel, and I really believe that it is the only thing that you can buy that makes you richer. And part of why I've traveled so young is that I know that when I get older, my condition won't allow me to have the same mobility as I have now. Mm-hmm. And when I travel, I see loads of old people, and I'm like, oh, they can't climb the stairs, and I don't want to be that person. Mm. So like, I want to see the world when I'm young and when I can. But yeah, going to India, it was just incredible. And I was really overwhelmed with like how helpful people were, because so many people said to me, be careful, you know, don't get robbed, don't get mugged, don't get raped. I was like, well, I'm not going
to
try.
That's what I hear when I go to India. It's like, don't go kalikuri, which means girl alone.
Yeah, exactly.
Then kuchhojuga, something will happen to you.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm overwhelmed with the friendliness I find there too.
Exactly. And I think because we don't see that in Punjab, like, you know, as I mentioned earlier, when you're with your family, you're never on your own, you experience things, but people were so friendly to me. People would just come and help, like, how my suitcase is bigger than me. Like, I didn't do the backpacking thing very well. so like, they could see I was struggling. People just come and help me. Like, it was perfect. I needed that. Lots of people wanted to come and have their photo taken with me.
Yeah.
One guy was like, oh, I saw you on the Discovery Channel. I was like, yeah, that was me. It wasn't me. I don't know what I agreed to being on Discovery Channel, but like, people kind of treat me like a bit of a celebrity. But then some people are like, oh my God, you're here on your own. Where's your husband? Where's your brother? Where's your dad? Who's going to do all the formalities? I was like, what formalities? They were like, well, who's going to sign this paper because you're checking into a hotel? I was like, me.
It's almost like you're a child, right?
Yeah, and then when I was there, also, they changed all of the currency overnight.
Oh, you must have been there the same time I was there when the Modi did demonetization. Oh, yeah. I lined up in a bank for 2 hours.
I did that.
And they gave me a bag full of 20, was it 20 rupee? I don't remember, but it was so much money in smaller notes because they demonetized. So I had to give all the big notes.
Yeah. So that was awful. And then I only could travel by Uber, and I could only eat wherever except for credit card, because obviously India's a cash country. So that was really interesting to live through whilst being there as well.
Wow, that's phenomenal. And where did you go that was most eye-opening for you? What experience during that trip did you find eye-opening?
I loved Bangalore. Had like, so before I went, I knew I was going to go to some places, but I also had the freedom to tailor my travels when I was there. Booked a lot on the go, which was lovely, because you know, you get to speaking to other people and they give you different recommendations. I think my most favorite place I went to was Dharamsala in Himachal Pradesh.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, I didn't feel like I was in India at all, and I mean that in a nice way, but it was incredible, the views, the people, the food. I went to a teaching by the Dalai Lama. You just don't expect to be there and that to be in India from what we see or experience. That was the most incredible. Bangalore was pleasantly surprising. I felt like I was in London, but with less people and it being more green and nice and cheaper.
A lot cheaper. I'm just in London and I've just come here for the first time. I'm surprised everything's, they say Melbourne is expensive. Trust me, London is more expensive than Melbourne.
So super expensive.
Yeah, wow. So you really liked Bangalore.
I really liked Bangalore. I'd definitely go back there. I'd like even consider like living there for a while as well. I've really loved it.
It's a place to take the Asian Women Festival.
I love Mumbai. I've been a few times now. I love having tea at the Taj Hotel. Love the afternoon tea there. I actually love tea, if anybody knows me.
I love that you went and you traveled and you did this 3 months solo.
Yeah.
Where did you get the courage to do that? Like what was it that compelled you? It sounds like throughout your life you've never done the easy thing. You've always done the hard thing, right? And part of it has been driven by your parents. But I'm curious, where does that boldness come from for you?
I don't know.
Are there people or moments along the way that have reminded you of your own capability, or is it something innate for you?
I think it's definitely something innate. I think as well that I'm often reminded either by society or people or the environment of limitations people think I have. I've achieved so much in my life and I've achieved a lot more than people that don't have a condition or don't have a short stature of 3'10". Like essentially I'm the height of a 4-year-old and that's hard. Like that's not easy. And imagine like I run events for like people like Anthony Joshua, Tyson Fury, Floyd Mayweather. These are world champion sportsmen. Wow. They don't turn up to these events thinking that I'm the one person running the show. So I love being able to actually challenge perceptions every day in everything that I do. But I think because all the messaging to me is like, you tick this box with your disability, therefore you can't do this. Therefore you're viewed as either a benefit scrounger or a Paralympian. I'm just like, no, actually, I'm going to actually do what I want and show that we can be different and share that middle ground story of everyone just getting on with their life. And I think that's where it comes from. It's not that I want to prove something to people. I think there was an element of that between like 18 and 25 maybe, because that was a time where I think I experienced a lot of different challenges, like learning how to drive. I had to wait 2 years for the DVLA, which is like the driving standards agency, whatever they're called, to deem me fit to drive. Like, wow. I know I'm fit to drive, but like, why do I have to go for that? So at that time, it was like challenge after challenge after challenge. And then suddenly in my mid-20s, there were no more challenges. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, what do I do now? I'm bored. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I'm used to like...
sort of inventing new challenges.
Inventing, becoming more always entrepreneurial. Having something to do.
Wow.
But I love it. I love it. And I love the fact that I'm able to give back. I'm able to create social impact. Yeah. I'm inspiring others. I'm creating a platform for others. I love it. I don't see it as work. It's something that I enjoy. And people often ask me, like, how do you have time to do all of this? I'm like, I love it.
Because I know, right, things that you do out because you work full-time and myself as well, and then you do these additional projects. Yeah. But then I think Lily Singh says something I love, which she always says, busy is a blessing.
Yeah.
And I love that, especially when you love what you're doing.
Yeah. Like, don't get me wrong, and you will know this. You have to make sacrifices. Of course, I would love to be out on a Friday night with my friends every Friday night, but I can't do that all the time because I've got to prioritize my projects that I've started and invested in.
And it's that longer term satisfaction, right?
Yeah.
All right. So we're almost running out of time, but I have a couple of last questions for you. Okay. And one is, what is your favorite book, perhaps a book that you would gift to someone? And what is your favorite podcast or one that you've been listening to recently that you'd like to share with our listeners?
So there's two books that I wanted to talk about. So I actually gifted this to my younger niece, and it is Lily Singh's book, How to Be a Boss.
Yeah.
I loved that book, and I gave it to my niece. She's 16 years old, and I, read it at the age of 32. And if I'd read that at 16, boy, would I have felt empowered. It's just an incredible book. It's not only relevant if you're South Asian, it's just relevant for everybody, whatever age you are. So that's definitely a book that I have gifted and would gift again. But a book that I would really want to recommend and again would gift, it's called The Skills, and it's by a journalist, and her name is Michelle Hussein. And I don't know if you've heard.
No, I haven't. And I'm pretty sure she's
British. Yeah. She's Asian, and it's a book that inspires, champions, and encourages women to make their ambitions a reality by focusing on the practical skills that make a difference.
Wow,
it's incredible. Like, this is one of these. If you could call a book life changing, I would say it is this. It's kind of like you could use it as like your, I guess, Bible or, yeah, going through life. It's brilliant.
That's
and
fantastic.
The way that she breaks things down, and she is a very successful BBC News reporter. She talks about her own experiences of being a South Asian woman and the things that she had to navigate, you know, not only being a South Asian woman, being a mother, being a wife, a daughter of, you know, it's fantastic. It's incredible.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. Thanks for sharing those. They both sound, especially the second one, sounds very practical. I have read Lily Singh's one.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing those two. And your favorite podcast, or one that you've been listening to?
Yeah. So I really love a podcast called No Country for Young Women. It's you'll be able to find it on BBC iPlayer. Or a BBC Sounds, and it's a podcast about love, life, and work in a white man's world. And it's the presenters are Sadia Azmat and Monty, and they're both women of color. Sadia is a comedian. She was actually she performed at the Asian Women Festival. So Sadia is she wears a hijab, but she doesn't talk about the things that you would expect her to. So she talks quite openly about sex. You know, we never hear or see of that really in mainstream media. So yeah, I think at the festival she shocked a few people, but she went down really well. And their podcast is like an extension of what she talks about and touches upon, and they interview great women of color.
That sounds so fascinating. Yeah, no, thanks so much for sharing those. I'm a podcast TED Talk junkie, so I love like accumulating more podcasts to listen to. It's always my to-go thing to do on trains. But this has been absolutely wonderful. Thanks. I mean, I guess I contacted you so last minute and you said yes. I was like, I was in London. I'm not going to do some work for a week. What do I do? I'm like, I'm going to do a podcast. And this is, you'll say, your first podcast, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And it's, you're my second interview today, which has been fantastic. But this has been so good. Thank you so much. And I really look forward to the next Asian Women Festival.
Thank you.
And I look forward to watching you make it go global as well.
Yeah, and, you know, hopefully we can bring it to Australia.
Yes, I think that would be so exciting. Let's see how we go.